We're joined now by Tim Redman. He's the editor of 48hills.org, a blog about the city and county of San Francisco. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
First of all, 654 votes by my count. That is the amount currently separating Mark Leno, who's in front, and London Breed in the runoff tabulation for the San Francisco mayor's race. Can you explain what happens next? What's left to be counted? How long does it take? When will people find out?
Yeah, what happens is they now have to count all of what they call the election day absentees. In other words, all of the ballots that were turned in, all the vote by mail ballots that were turned in at polling places on election day, plus all of the vote by mail ballots that were postmarked in time, but for some reason due to the U.S. mail didn't arrive in the Department of Elections until today or tomorrow. So that could be 20,000, 30,000 votes, a significant number, given past reports. So we don't know. I mean, it's very, very close now. And then there's two factors to think about. One is that the ranked choice voting strategy of Leno and Kim seems to have worked in the sense that with Jane Kim in third, the vast majority of her second place votes went to Leno by a factor of like 4-1. All right. So if that continues and the ranks stay the same, Leno will probably win. However, on election day, if you take out the early absentees, the vote by mail, on election day, Jane Kim got 20,000 votes, Mark Leno got 18,500, and London Breed got 25,800. So it is possible that when they count all those other ballots, Jane Kim will wind up in second place, which will change the entire calculus. So it's still very, very much up in the air.
Well, there's a third possibility, which is that London Breed picks up a lot more votes. Aren't absentee votes typically a little bit more conservative than the city as a whole?
Typically, the election day absentees break the same way as the votes on election day, typically. All right, so this is still way too close to call, and we may not know for another day or two. We'll probably know a lot more around 4 o'clock today when they release the results of the votes that were turned, the first group of votes that they've counted, because then at least we'll see what that pattern is.
Yeah.
But there's no question that for the moment, if the pattern holds, it appears that the ranked choice voting strategy has been successful.
What is the significance of Mark Leno, if he becomes mayor, winning the election?
Well, other than the historic fact that he would be the first openly gay mayor of San Francisco, which is a very big deal, of course, it's the significance is that the people who've been running the city, and by that I mean the most influential folks and the people behind the scenes, the senior staffers in the mayor's office who've really been running things for the last 7 years, will be out. And we will see a significant change at City Hall in terms of who's calling the shots, who's behind the scenes, who's pushing the agenda. The big tech and real estate went all in for London Breed in a huge way with lots of money. And Leno knows that, and Kim knows that, and Breed knows that. And, I think it's not as if Mark Leno is going to take office and immediately radically restructure everything in San Francisco, but it's going to be a different approach than we've seen certainly for the past 7 years. It would be a significant difference.
But, I mean, so this is the confusing thing about San Francisco politics to me. The last time Mark Leno was in San Francisco politics, he was associated, if I'm not mistaken, with the same establishment wing of politics that London Breed now is. He was initially appointed to a seat on the Board of Supervisors by then Mayor Willie Brown. When he ran for the state legislature the first time against Carol Migdon, you endorsed against him.
We endorsed him against Carol Migdon.
Oh, you endorsed him against Carol Migdon. Excuse me.
Yes, we did. Wow. Yeah, we endorsed him against Carol Migdon. He was indeed originally appointed by Willie Brown, and he was on the Board of Supervisors as Brown's appointee, fairly loyal to Willie Brown on a lot of issues. But he's moved a long way from that, and in this race, it became very clear that the establishment, the establishment now in San Francisco is big tech and real estate. There was a time when you had the Chamber of Commerce and you had finance companies and you had big corporations that were, you know, Chevron and people like that. That's all gone now. The influence in San Francisco, the power structure is big tech and real estate. And it's become very clear that whatever anyone else thinks, big tech and real estate didn't think that Leno was going to be a mayor that they would support. So, you know, just based on that, based on the fact that they went all in for Breed, it is an indication that, well, yes, I agree, Mark Leno is not going to radically overturn everything in the city. It is an indication that we are looking at a change in direction at City Hall. There's no question about it. If, in fact, he ends up on top. But this is still way too close to call, and we don't know for sure.
So what are the consequential decisions that the mayor would be in a position to change? I mean, what substantively will be better for different for the people in San Francisco if Mark Leno is mayor versus London Breed?
Well, the next mayor of San Francisco needs to regulate the tech industry in a way that hasn't been done in the past. For example, if Mark Leno had been mayor instead of Ed Lee, I don't think Airbnb would have been able to do what it did in the city, which is for 3 years operate completely illegally, allowing and encouraging the conversion of thousands and thousands of apartments to hotel rooms, causing many, many tenants to lose their homes. I don't think Leno would have allowed that. I don't think he would have allowed Uber and Lyft to operate the way they did illegally in the city, congesting the city streets with 50,000 cars with no regulation at all. So I do think that's going to make a significant difference. The tenants groups strongly supported a Leno-Kim dual endorsement. And I think when it comes to Leno has been very strong on the Ellis Act, on trying to overturn the Ellis Act. I think that he would fully fund immediately the measure that passed, which, by the way, we haven't gotten into this yet, but Prop F was very, very significant. San Francisco has just become the first city in California to guarantee any tenant facing an eviction the right to legal counsel and free legal counsel if you can't afford it. Leno will fund that immediately. So on a lot of different, and it's also, it's just a question of who gets listened to in the mayor's office. And I think if Leno does pull this out, the tenants, the environmentalists, the neighborhood folks, the folks who believe that we need to grow a little more slowly and regulate tech a little better will get be listened to in the mayor's office, and I think they would not be under London Breed.
Most notably because of the special election in District 8 of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. That seat was flipped from an appointed incumbent, Jeff Sheehy, to challenger Raphael Mandelman, associated with the progressive wing of San Francisco politics. A Leno mayor would also have a progressive majority on the Board of Supervisors to work with. It would be the first time that's happened in my lifetime, if I'm not mistaken.
In a long, long, yes, that is probably true. I don't think Art Agnos ever had a progressive majority on the Board of Supervisors to work with. So yes, a Leno morality with the 6-vote progressive majority on the Board of Supervisors would be very unusual and a major difference from the way things have been run in the city for at least the last 20 years.
So let's talk about kind of the balance of forces in San Francisco politics. Let's start with that tenants' rights measure you mentioned. Pretty pioneering piece of legislation. Universal right to counsel paid for by the city for any tenant who gets an eviction notice. It didn't just pass narrowly. The last time I checked the returns, it had a more than 11 percentage point margin, despite what appeared to be a large amount of spending by the landlord lobby, the California Apartment Association, pouring money through various PACs, as documented at 48hills.org, your website.
Yes.
What do you make of the fact that it got such a strong showing?
People in this city are sick of the way things have been going. People are sick of the evictions. They're sick of, and I think people are starting to make the connection that one of the reasons there are so many homeless people on the streets is that people are losing their homes. I have the latest data that I've seen suggest that as many as 100 people in San Francisco become homeless every month. And those are people who used to have a home in San Francisco and for some reason, for whatever reason, have lost it. A lot of them due to eviction. So I think people are making that connection and saying we can't solve the homeless problem unless we solve the eviction problem. So that is a big deal. There are a couple of really significant things that happened. Prop F passing is a very significant deal. Prop H losing as big as it did, despite the fact that the Police Officers Association spent a ton of money trying to promote it, is a very big deal. It shows that the Police Officers
Let's back up, explain what Prop H was. This was a proposal to authorize the police in San Francisco to use tasers earlier than had already been approved by the Civilian Police Commission in San Francisco, and also under a more permissive set of rules, a set of rules that couldn't be changed or tweaked after the fact because they would have been created by voters.
That's correct, and in fact, it would have authorized all police officers to carry tasers with very permissive rules. That went down pretty heavily, and it you know, what the activists told me is everywhere they went in the neighborhoods, every group they went to, once they said the Police Officers Association is behind this, it was over. That Police Officers Association in San Francisco no longer has any credibility at all. And that's a significant change, too. So we're seeing a lot of significant changes in the electorate. Now, let us remember the mayor's race is not over. The turnout was was quite low so far. We won't know, but it's a 30%+ turnout. It's not a very high turnout election, but we are seeing, I think.
But it's an off-year primary ballot. I mean, if you compare it to other off-year elections, how does it look?
It's still a little low. It's definitely lower than off-year mayor's races in November. Typically, the San Francisco elects a mayor in an off-year, in an odd-numbered year. It would have been 2019 in a November election. For a mayor's race, it's low turnout. I think a lot of people weren't thinking that there is a mayor's race. I think that the mainstream media in San Francisco did not do a good job of making clear to people that there is a mayor's race and what the stakes were. Nevertheless, the pattern of votes that we've seen from D8 through the Prop H, Prop F, and the mayor's race suggests that there's a significant change in the way voters are viewing the powers that be, the existing power structure, and the policy patterns that we've seen in the city for the last 7 years.
Speaking to Tim Redmond, he is the editor of 48hills.org. Okay, we've been through the mayor's race, we've been through Proposition F, we've been through Proposition H, and we mentioned briefly the fact that an election in District 8 of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors has actually flipped control of the Board of Supes. Last time progressives had a majority in San Francisco, it did not hold together for very long. David Chu was touted as a progressive on his way into office, not really considered part of that wing later in his term before he moved up to the state legislature. How much coherence do you expect among the six supervisors who nominally make up the progressive wing of politics now?
Well, that will be a very interesting question. I mean, Rafael Mandelman has always been part of Progressive San Francisco. He ran a neighborhood-based campaign. He didn't run as, you know, I'm to the left of Jeff Sheehy. He ran as, I'm going to do better for the neighborhood. I do think that you've got to remember, in the past when we've had progressive majorities on the Board of Supervisors, we've had Gavin Newsom as mayor, or in the early days, Ed Lee. It was hard for the progressives to get anything through, because anything important that they did, the mayor was going to veto. That's going to be different now, so that will change the calculus significantly. So I think the group that now makes up the progressive bloc is more coherent and is more likely to work together than we have seen sometimes in the past.
Tim Redmond, I know you keep one eye on the local ballot and one eye on the state ballot. In your capacity as the person who owns the remains of the San Francisco Bay Guardian, you've made endorsements in both races. Any insights into what happened further up on the ballot?
I continue to shake my head and say, I can't believe Gavin Newsom's going to be the governor of California. I have known Gavin Newsom since he was a recreation and parks commissioner in San Francisco, and you just sometimes wonder, you know, how do things like this happen? But that appears, I mean, I don't think there's very much question about it. It looks like Gavin Newsom is going to be the next governor of California. I have not plugged in too closely to the other races this morning and looked at the final results.
Yeah, what would you expect from a Gavin Newsom governor? I mean, he's been lieutenant governor for two terms now. That does not give someone an opportunity to rack up much of a track record to examine.
No, but he had a track record as mayor of San Francisco. What we're going to see is a lot of flash and dazzle, and A lot of press conferences and a lot of bold announcements with all kinds of bold policy ideas. And if the pattern from San Francisco remains, much of that will never happen. We used to call him Mayor Press Release because he was always full of, I'm going to do this. But when it came right down to making it happen on the ground, he was, first of all, quite a pro-business conservative mayor. And number two, a lot of the things that he touted never really came to pass. And then, of course, what he loves to do is take credit for other people's ideas. He's been going around the state saying, I brought universal health care to San Francisco. Actually, Tom Amiano brought universal health care to San Francisco, and Gavin Newsom resisted it, kicking and screaming every step of the way, because he didn't want businesses to have to pay for it. And only at the very end were they able to drag him along to say yes, and now he's claiming that that was his idea.
Yeah, but so, does he answer to a different set of interests once he's installed as governor of California?
No. I think he answers to the same set of interests that he's always answered to. And the thing about Gavin Newsom is Gavin has always been about Gavin Newsom. Right? He has always been about getting himself elected to higher office. Whatever principles he has are subsumed by his monumental political ego and drive. So I think what we will see is a Gavin Newsom who will be out and around, waving his arms and promising the world to people, and we will see probably very few major policy accomplishments coming out of the governor's office. That's my prediction.
Under the governorship of Jerry Brown, basically the Democratic leadership of the state legislature has been to the left of the governor, and the governor has played a major moderating effect. But that's partly because Jerry Brown is someone who knows how to pull every lever of power in state politics. If Gavin Newsom is, as you're describing him, someone who's going to be a little more hands-off, all hat and no cattle, does that mean state politics might move a little bit further to the left just because there's not as much of a counterweight in the governor's office?
Entirely possibly, particularly on things like health care. I mean, Gavin Newsom did promise, and a big part of his campaign was single-payer health care. Now, he then said towards the end of the race, well, I love single-payer health care, but it's not going to happen during my term. It's a long-term goal, which is a classic kind of Gavin Newsom thing to do, to promise us single-payer health care and then say, oh, well, we'll have single-payer health care 20 years from now. But as we start to move in that direction, he will not be in a position to resist the way Jerry Brown did. And the other thing is, Jerry Brown was cheap. I mean, Jerry didn't like to spend money. And that's kind of the way he's always been, as governor, as mayor of Oakland. He kept a tight fist on the checkbook. I don't know if Gavin's going to be the same. I think that if the Democrats come in and have worthwhile proposals that are worth funding, I'm not sure that Gavin will resist spending money quite the way Jerry Brown did, particularly on things that he thinks will make him look good.
All right. We should mention for our listeners' benefit, Gavin Newsom is not actually assured the governor's mansion yet. He will have to get through an election on the November ballot. But he has the good fortune to be running against a Republican, John Cox, in that election, which, given the gap between Democratic and Republican registration in the state of California, means he would have to be engulfed by a pretty bad scandal to lose that election. Tim Redmond, thank you so much for speaking to us today.
Of course. Happy to anytime.
Tim Redmond is the editor of 48 Hills. You can read his writing and that of the writers he edits at 48hills.org.